Welcome to the California Slap Law Podcast. California's Slap Law was a great idea, but it can be a minefield for the uninformed. To guide you through that minefield, here's your host,
one of a kind,
from the law firm of Morris & Stone, Aaron Morris.
According to a company called Comparably, Morris & Stone is in the running for the Best Company Culture Award for 2024. Fingers crossed. Welcome to the 34th episode of the California Slap Law Podcast. My name is Aaron Morris. I'm a partner with the Southern California boutique law firm of Morris & Stone. If we can be of assistance with anything having to do with free speech, defamation, or anti-slap motions, or if you need to fight an inflated attorney fee application following an anti-slap motion, please feel free to call at 714-954-0700 or email me at morris@toplawfirm.com. Entertaining times at Morris & Stone as we make opposing counsel squirm. The victories just keep rolling in. I finally convinced the Court of Appeal in a published opinion to prohibit what I have long referred to as an all-or-nothing anti-slap motion. That will be today's primary case, but first I want to discuss cases involving calls to the police. We're suddenly getting a rash of these cases that arise from reports to the police. Now, prior to 2021, calls to the police were absolutely privileged. No matter how false or vile, no matter what the motivation for calling the police, you could not sue for defamation for something said to the police. The reasoning was simple. Picture that you're a victim of a crime and you report the criminal to the police. If that criminal was free to sue you for defamation for what you'd said to the police, that would make a very effective means to harass the victim. It doesn't matter that what you said to the police was absolutely true. The criminal could sue you and make you spend tens of thousands of dollars defending against his defamation action. He could make you sit across the table from him as he takes your deposition for that defamation action. You might just decide not to prosecute the criminal action in exchange for him agreeing to dismiss the defamation action. That does not mean that one is free to lie to the police with impunity. Filing a false police report is a crime. And if the accused criminal is found not guilty, then they can sue the person for malicious prosecution for what they said to the police. The absolute privilege just means that you can't sue someone for defamation or any other tort other than malicious prosecution for what they said to the police. But that changed in 2021. The California legislature, in its infinite wisdom, decided to amend Civil Code Section 47 and change the absolute privilege to a conditional privilege. You can now sue for defamation for a false police report. If you call the police, you can now suffer the harassment at the hands of the criminal I just described. I think it was a terrible idea to make the change, but as a result of that amendment, I'm getting even more anti-slap cases because attorneys think they can sue with impunity for calls to the police. They think that if they sue for defamation and infliction of emotional distress for a report to the police, they can defeat any anti-slap motion because the plaintiff's evidence must be taken as true. Let me use one of my recent cases to illustrate what I'm talking about. As always, changing the facts slightly, my client had a beautiful lakeside home and had lived there in peace for many years. Unfortunately, the house next door on the lake was purchased by someone who had no intention of ever living there. We'll call him Snidely. Snidely's plan was to rent the house out as a party house. This destroyed the peaceful living of my client, and he frequently had to call the police to report loud parties, illegal parking, and illegal bonfires. The use of the home was also contrary to the zoning laws, so he had contacted code enforcement. Snidely was not happy. Due to my client's calls to the police, the parties would often be shut down for excessive noise, and the partygoers' cars would be ticketed or towed. As a result, he was getting terrible reviews on Airbnb and often had to refund the rental fees. And he'd already been contacted by code enforcement. If they shut him down, he would lose this great source of income. So Snidely decided to go on the offensive by suing my client for defamation. He alleged that the complaints about loud parties were all false. Quite to the contrary, his tenants used the home only for quiet prayer meetings. And he added a claim for intentional infliction of emotional distress, claiming that all these false calls of the police had forced him to seek therapy. Finally, he sued for interference with prospective economic advantage since he had lost business due to my client's reports. He sought $2.7 million in damages plus punitive damages in an amount to be determined. Now, I'm sure in his mind, he reasoned that in the face of that level of potential damages, my client might decide to endure the noise, parking, and illegal bonfires and withdraw his complaint to the police or at least never call them again. But what about the anti-slap statute? Wouldn't those calls to the police be protected speech? As I said, prior to 2021, they would have been absolutely protected. There would be no evidence Snidely could present to satisfy the second prong of the anti-slap analysis. But now you can sue for police reports, so here is how Snidely's attorney thought he would overcome any anti-slap motion, assuming that he considered the anti-slap statute at all. In the context of an anti-SLAPP motion, the plaintiff's evidence must be taken as true. Why, you ask? Well, granting an anti-SLAPP motion deprives the plaintiff of their right to a trial, so that can only be done if, as a matter of law, they have failed to state a claim. If the judge weighed the evidence, that would mean he or she is making an evidentiary decision without the benefit of a trial, and that is not permitted. The simplest way to determine whether a plaintiff has stated a viable claim is to take his evidence as true and ignore the defendant's evidence. If plaintiff can't state a claim even when all of his evidence is taken as true, then, as a matter of law, he has failed to state a claim and his complaint can be stricken. This isn't unique to anti-SLAPP motions. The same is true of summary judgment motions and with demurs, where all of the plaintiff's allegations are taken as true. So Snidely appears to be in the catbird's seat. How can he possibly lose an anti-SLAPP motion if all of his evidence is going to be taken as true? Well, here's the way it would play out. Snidely would sue for defamation for the calls to the police and code enforcement and await for the inevitable anti-SLAPP motion. Defendant would file the anti-SLAPP motion supported by a declaration attesting that all the calls to the police were true and necessary due to the loud parties and such. Snidely would then oppose the motion with his own declaration, stating that there had never been a loud party at the house, only quiet prayer meetings. Since Snidely's evidence must be taken as true, defendant's evidence would be disregarded, and the anti-SLAPP motion would be denied, since if there was never a loud party, then all of the defendant's calls to the police were indeed false and defamatory. That, no doubt, was the reasoning of Snidely's attorney and every other attorney who has filed a defamation action based on calls to the police. But here is where they are wrong. Let's take a look at the wording of the 2021 amendment to Section 47. This subdivision does not make privileged any communication between a person and a law enforcement agency in which the person makes a false report that another person has committed or is in the act of committing a criminal act or is engaged in an activity requiring law enforcement intervention, knowing that the report is false or with reckless disregard for the truth or falsity of the report. So keeping that wording in mind, let's get back to Snidely. The reports to the police are privileged. The 2021 amendment does not change that. Calls to the police automatically satisfy the first prong of the anti-SLAPP analysis. So now we turn to the second prong to see if Snidely can show that he is more likely than not to succeed on his claims. He filed his declaration stating that there had never been a loud party at his house. Since that must be taken as true, he has proven that the reports were false. But under the amendment, Snidely must also prove that my client knew the report was false. What evidence can Snidely possibly present that gets into the mind of my client to prove that he knew his reports were false? The answer is a big fat nada. He has no such evidence. He will argue that he doesn't have to show that my client knew that his reports were false. He can also satisfy the amendment by showing that my client acted with reckless disregard for the truth or falsity. He will claim that since he has said there was never a loud party, and my client reported him for 15 loud parties, then obviously my client must be acting with reckless disregard for the truth. Snidely might even offer the police reports as evidence because they show that Snidely has never been cited for a loud party. But that's not enough because of the very nature of the report. Loud is a matter of opinion. Perhaps in the opinion of the responding officers, the parties were not that loud, but that does not mean that my client's differing opinion is wrong. Or perhaps they just arrived after the loud party. That is the key point these attorneys are missing. The plaintiff can claim that the reports were false, but presenting evidence that the defendant knew the reports were false is really tough. So the analysis plays out just as it did before the 2021 amendment. The reports to the police satisfy the first prong as protected speech, and plaintiff cannot present any evidence to overcome that privilege. This case had a fun twist. Stick around for the after show to hear the tale. So back on December 27, 2023, a slightly belated Christmas present, the Court of Appeal issued a published opinion on one of my cases. I have for years been arguing that it is improper for a court to strike allegations of protected speech unless the defendant specifically asked for those allegations to be stricken. This decision finally agreed with me, so I now have a precedent I can cite to from one of my own cases. Here's what I'm talking about. I file a beautifully crafted complaint for defamation. Being the slap master, I am, of course, very careful not to include any allegations of protected speech. Nonetheless, defense counsel dares to bring an anti-slap motion against my complaint under some crazy theory that I have based the complaint on protected speech. Other times, the claims are not so crazy, and I necessarily alleged protected speech. For example, if someone defames my client in a Yelp review of my client's business, that review will be found to satisfy the first prong of the anti-slap analysis. There's no way to get around that, but I am confident that I can show that the statements were defamatory and hence satisfy the second prong. So anyway, the defendant brings an anti-SLAPP motion and in the notice of motion seeks only to strike the entire complaint or perhaps entire causes of action. The defendant does not identify any individual allegations he wants to strike. I prepare and file my opposition to the anti-SLAPP motion. Upon receiving my opposition, defense counsel changes his tune. In his reply, he says to the court, "Dear Judge, you remember when I filed this motion and said that this was the slappiest slap in recorded history and that the entire complaint should therefore be stricken? Well, I kind of had my head up my butt, and what I meant to say is that even if this court decides not to strike the entire complaint, it should strike paragraphs 12, 17, 23, and 36, which clearly allege protected speech. Because it is clear after reading the opposition that there is zero chance you're going to strike the entire complaint. But if you strike those four paragraphs, I can claim that I prevailed on the motion and seek fees. How is that fair to me and my client? I've already filed my opposition and never got to address that argument. Most likely, as part of the anti-SLAPP analysis, I did address the purported allegations of protected speech, but if defendant is seeking to strike individual allegations, that should have been in the notice of motion. So I always argued at oral argument, the only chance I had to respond, that the motion needed to be treated as an all or nothing motion. The defendant asked only that the entire complaint be stricken, so that is the only relief the court can grant. But my argument was seldom discussed because the motion was always denied. The court had no reason to address my all or nothing argument if it was already denying the motion on other grounds. But in this case, it came up at the trial court and on appeal. I represented a contractor and the defendant had posted reviews with absurd accusations against my client. For example, she wrote, quote, "I filed the complaint with the contractor's licensing board because he replaced seven windows using windows he had stolen from Home Depot and then charged me for the windows. My complaint alleged that was false and defamatory." In his anti-SLAPP motion, defense counsel argued that the statement was protected because defendant was discussing a complaint to the contractor's licensing board. In my opposition, I explained that a complaint to the contractor's licensing board is protected, but talking about that complaint is not. So in his reply, defense counsel adopted a new strategy. He said, "Dear Judge, you know when I asked you to strike the entire complaint, I really meant that you should strike individual allegations. For example, you know where my client wrote, quote, 'I filed a complaint with the contractor's licensing board because he replaced seven windows using windows he had stolen from Home Depot and then charged me for the windows.' Truth is an absolute defense to defamation, so you should break that statement down into parts and strike those parts that are true. So look at the first part. I filed a complaint with the contractor's licensing board. That's absolutely true. She did file a complaint with the contractor's licensing board. It was denied, but she filed it, so that is a true statement and should be stricken. Then the next part is, quote, 'He replaced seven windows.' Again, that's absolutely true. He replaced seven windows. How can he even claim that is defamatory when he did, in fact, replace seven windows? How is it even defamatory to say that someone replaced seven windows? And he did charge her to replace those seven windows. That is absolutely true. That has to be stricken. That just leaves, quote, 'stolen from Home Depot.' But with the rest of the statement stricken, that no longer has any context, so how can it be defamatory? If I walk up to someone and say, 'stolen at Home Depot,' they're just going to look at me weird because they won't know what I'm talking about. But it certainly is not defamatory, so that should be stricken as just plain stupid." Well, the trial court denied the motion, but defense counsel thought that it was such a great argument that he took it up on appeal. The Court of Appeal was not impressed. In its opinion, it stated, "Appellants may not enlist the courts as their legal assistant to develop arguments they merely suggest. The duty to present legal analysis belongs to the parties. It would be unfair for one side to loft an undeveloped legal idea, to rely on the court to work it out, and to leave the opposing party with nothing concrete to tackle in the briefing." Motion denied. With a regular motion to strike, the moving party must identify what they want to be stricken. It must be specifically quoted. The only exceptions are, you can ask that an entire paragraph be stricken and just identify it by paragraph number, or you can ask that entire causes of action be stricken. But if you want specific allegations to be stricken, you have to quote those allegations and ask that they be stricken. It just makes sense to do so as a fallback in case the court does not agree that the entire complaint should be stricken or the entire causes of action should be stricken. But if there's no request that an allegation be stricken, the court shouldn't take it upon itself to do it. Thanks for listening. Have a great week and try not to slap anyone. In the first case I discussed, I have to give some credit to Snidely's attorney and then take it away. I think he knew enough about anti-SLAPP law to know that he might be straying into those waters based on the way he alleged the causes of action. He came up with an argument as to why the calls to the police were illegal. Illegal conduct is not protected, so he probably reasoned that if he could show that the calls were illegal, then he could circumvent the privilege afforded to calls to the police. When he received my anti-slap motion, he called the next day and offered to dismiss the case if my client would waive his attorney's fees. He apparently realized his argument that the calls were illegal would not carry the day. So I give him credit for trying to save his client from further attorney fees. My client would not agree to waive all the fees, but we did offer a discount. Plus, Snidely would avoid having to pay his attorney for the opposition brief and would avoid the cost of my reply brief, not to mention the cost of the motion for attorney's fees. I was anticipating a counteroffer on the fees and was surprised when I received the opposition. Apparently, Snidely decided to double down. I hope for the sake of the attorney that it was Snidely who gave the order to march forward. Otherwise, he's going to get an earful of, I could have walked away for that amount, and now I have to pay how much? As it turned out, the check came from Snidely's attorney, so I think there was probably an issue there. Have a good one, and don't be Snidely.